Well, hello everybody, my name's Larry Thomas and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm living proof that there's a bottom of the barrel. I want to thank the committee for letting me come out and be with you again. And it's okay. We've had a great time. I want to thank Harlan and everybody, and especially my driver, Don. Don picked me up at the airport, me and my wife. I want to thank her for coming with us, and me and my committee. Don picked us up at the airport, and he'd been making that run all day, I guess, because when we got into the van, there was a six-pack of Red Bull. And they were all gone, all right? He'd been showing the sights to all the other speakers on their way in, you know? Well, by the time he got me and Rosie, he just threw our ass in the van and just locked it shut, you know? And we're pressed up against the glass, you know, wanting to see some of the stuff. We would see something that we wanted to see, and Don would just, oh, yeah, that's a bridge. No big deal, you know? Yeah, we don't got time. You know, this guy, man, just making a beeline, you know, and everything we wanted to see and stuff, he just told us about. Yep, that's just a ship. It's okay. That's just a forest. That's okay, you know. This guy was determined to get here, man, you know, and the only time he would say something is when he would see some land that he bought. Yep, that's mine, you know. Yep, that's mine, you know what I mean? But we made it and everything. We've had a great meeting and a great, great weekend. There's a lot of people that I love here, and they should be here shortly. It's been said all week, and a lot of us cross paths a lot, and I love these guys that I'm with. You know, there was a gal that spoke earlier on this week, and the last time I remember her, we were speaking at a conference in Bakersfield, and it was a pretty good sized one, you know, and we were sharing the hotel with 2,000 Jehovah's Witnesses. Well, that ain't so bad. However, I had a tremendous desire that around 4 o'clock in the morning, I wanted to grab a grapevine and go door to door. You know Bill and Bob love you? You know, yes, sir. Just to see how many of them would open up the door butt naked, you know, and I'll get rid of them, you know, My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober and not amount to a goddamn thing. I'm a little over 24 years, and I'm scratching the door at 25, and because of a program of... Alcoholics Anonymous, nothing would be possible. I'm no big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. The highest that I'm ever going to be is basic, sober, active member of a home group. If it ever gets any higher than that, I don't want any part of it. I'm looking at the face of God. I don't got to go anywhere else. I don't got to do nothing to get anything else done. Everything that I need to make me happy will be given to me by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything that hinders that happiness will be removed by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My search is over. My people are here. My life is in order because of a sponsor and a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And an amazing triangle because of a man, a sponsor, and a book called Alcoholics Anonymous and this thing called identification. Me, you, and that book. They don't get any better than that. Nothing better than that, you know. And I never want to forget that, you know. I'll never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that from a personal experience. There's nothing sadder than coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, standing at that door, wondering, will I ever be a part of that crowd? Will I ever be in there? How come I'm always at that door? And if you knew, I know you're in a hell of a spot. You're in one hell of a spot, and that seems to be the nightmare of this alcoholic, is I keep winding up in that spot. And I'll try not to drink, and I'll go as far as I can. And the nightmare of this alcoholic is that I kept drinking, and I kept getting sober, and there was no middle of the road answer, and I was destined to find it. There had to be a middle of the road answer. Why? Because when I'm not drinking, I'm as crazy as I can be, and sobriety seems to drive me to drink time and time and time again. And I'm surrounded by people, and they're telling me, Larry, if you don't drink, everything's going to be all right. And I don't drink, and everything is not all right. And I come to these meetings, and I see these goofs with these ties on, and they're telling me wonderful things like, 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you, you know. And I'm thinking, my God, I came in with that guy, you know. You know. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life. There's not one decent thing that's ever happened to me that's been to my liking. Everything about Alcoholics Anonymous goes against the grain, which is why it works so good. It has nothing to do with me. If you come here to get sober, I feel sorry for you. This is where you learn how to live now that you are sober. We've got a hideous disease that doesn't care how physically sober you are. We've got a hideous disease that doesn't care how mentally well you are. We've got a disease that medicine has tried to treat, and they wonder why we keep drinking and we keep getting loaded. It is impossible to treat a soul sickness with medicine. You treat the soul with the spirit, and it's either alcohol or the spirit removal called Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's no middle of the road answer, and I was destined to find that middle of the road answer because I didn't want to not drink, because when I'm not drinking, I'm absolutely out of my mind, and there's got to be another answer. There's got to be something besides not drinking, and I was destined to find it. And I was hell-bent on finding it, you know, and I come from a great home, you know. I have no problem with my upbringing at all. I got a great family, you know. I was born in Michigan, and I come out to California when I was about 4 years old, and I was put in a little foster home for a while, and my mom is a great little Scandinavian lady. I love my mom to death, man. My mom liked diet pills. My mom was always running around the house, you know, sorting out nuts and bolts in the middle of the night, you know, or raking the neighbor's yard around 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, and her favorite thing was to make Afghans, you know, and she'd take that speed and make Afghans all night. Just, you can hear her, man, you know, and everything in the house had an Afghan on it, you know. Chairs had Afghans, couches had Afghans. If there was any animals, they had a fresh little vest on them, you know, and always tight and pink, you know, and my dad had golf clubs with little poodle heads on them, you know. And you'd go in the bathroom, and toilet paper had a dog head on it, you know. And you drank enough, that dog would talk to you, you know. I know that for a fact, man, you know. Get your head out of that water, you bastard, you know. I mean, and her favorite hobby was to get that prescription filled and do these jigsaw puzzles. These 30 million piece jigsaw puzzles, you know, of the Mojave Desert, you know what I mean? Oh yeah, it's gonna be a beige night, man. There's no blue and gray tonight, man, you know. She'd run off to Savon's to get her a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because she'd save the coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, you know. One that I know Don knows all about, you know. And she'd come home, plop open that card table, take her a couple more Dexies, you know, and start putting together this piece of puzzle, and if she got a piece that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers. She just snipped that son of a bitch, you know. You know, we had a job to do, and she was going to do it, man, you know. I love my, no matter what hour you woke up, she was up. She was up, and she was doing shit. There was stuff to do, man, you know. And you grow up just looking for her, you know what I mean? And you know, mom's had all these rules. Mom had all these mom tales, you know. Don't play in the gutter, you'll get polio. You know. Don't ride a girl's bike, you'll get pregnant or some stuff, you know. You know, and burnt food is good for your gums. That was a good one, you know. Yeah, yeah. I'd be trying to sneak out around 5 in the morning. She'd have a plate of burnt toast right there, you know. Oh, don't you make that face. That burnt food is good for your gums, you know. Now, she don't have a tooth in her head, all right. God damn it, don't, you know. But I tell you, make no mistake, my mom loved me to death, and I loved her. I loved her to death, and I still do. I love that lady, you know. As I stand here today, I got to be honest with you. I'm cheating on my wife. I date that lady every week. I go see my mom every week. I call her every day, and when I don't call, she knows it. She wonders where I'm at. I don't ever want her to worry about where I'm at. I don't ever want that lady or any lady in my life to ever wonder where I'm about and what I'm doing. My life is no longer a secret here, you know. But I never want to forget. I never want to forget coming in and out of those institutions, and it's an April morning, and I've been gone for a long time, and my mom hadn't seen me for a long time, and I'm standing in the parking lot of a dry cleaner's, and I'm about from here to that back row. And it's an April morning and it's raining and I got my street mud on because I know everything there is to know about living on the streets. People ask me, how did you survive? You know how you survive on the streets? There's not a line you don't cross. There ain't nothing you won't do. There ain't a place you won't go. I know all about that. I know all about selling your soul. I know all about that. And I'm looking at my mom and she hadn't seen me for a long time. And the only thought that I have is that lady better have a dollar. And I walk across that rainy parking lot, and I lock eyes with my mother. And she's startled half to death, and she starts going through her little plastic wallet that she got on Woolworths. And a little picture of me falls out when I'm 8 years old. Little League picture. The only decent picture she's ever had of me. She's hanging on to that picture. And I asked her, and she gives me $2. And as I've turned to walk away, she says, Larry, what would it cost to get my son back? For me to run down to Wilmington, California, and to live in that junkyard one more time. Now that is not, say that to be dramatic, but the amazing thing about this man that stands in front of you today, bring him to Alcoholics Anonymous. Bring him with all of his desperation and his so-called hopelessness. Why is it if you put me and the secretary of a meeting that far, how come I can't walk that parking lot and ask him for a commitment in a meeting? But I could walk that same distance and use my mom one more time. If my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will. Make no mistake about that. And the longer I stay sober, the deeper those roots of selfishness get. And it was up to me to start doing something for you in Alcoholics Anonymous. That the idea of coming here to get anything had to be erased from my mind. That it was time for me to start doing for you. What is it you need to be done in that meeting? What is it that needs to be done in that home group? What can I do to get back to you? It's called giving. Foreign word to a selfish, self-centered man who's had his hand out his entire life. And if the government wasn't putting in there and the state wasn't putting under there, you start hanging on to people that you know will put someone in there, faking romance, faking trust, faking love. Everything's got the hand out. Always got the hand out. Give me, give me, give me. See, that's the kind of guy you got up here. You see, I don't know nothing about treating people decent. It's always been about me. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. My dad liked to drink and sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing, man, you know. And he's always sneaking through my bedroom window. He's a refinery worker, so you never know when he's sneaking in, you know. But every now and plant, he'd work that graveyard shift, and I'd feel that old greasy refinery boot coming down on my chest, you know. And I remember grabbing him one night, and I said, "Geez, Dad," I said, you know, "why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys?" You know, my God, she's up anyway, you know. I mean, I can hear the Hoover going now, you know. Boy, I tell you, Dad was something else. Dad was something else. I hang around Billy and I hang around my sponsor and I'm rubbing shoulders with my dad in Alcoholics. I know that. I know that today. My dad reeked of being a man. My dad made being a man just, you know, and he was an old World War II vet. He used to tell me things like, "You don't know how good you got it, kid. Back when I was your age, we really had it tough." And he did. He had it really tough. His father died at a young age, choked on his tongue in an alcoholic convulsion. His mother hung herself in a Detroit jail, and he brought up his kid brother with one dream. That was to go to the United States Navy and come out, bring my mom out of that convent and marry her. Come out to California and live their dream. And I become the nightmare of that dream. But that man made being a man look good. My dad was the kind of thing that everything he started, he finished. You amazing that? Everything, that my dad was the kind of guy that he started working at a chemical plant as a janitor, and 35 years later become the plant manager, head of OSHA of that chemical plant. He knows how to hang in. He knows, I don't know about hanging in. Besides being an alcoholic, I got a 5-inch belt of lazy ass that straps around here that Rosie knows all about. She's been trying to unbuckle for 10 years, you know. You got to pay me to do chores around my own house, you know, but... You know, put in a water heater for somebody in AA, I'm right there, you know what I mean? But, oh, yeah, you know, I just want to, I'm a people pleaser, man. Me and Wayne were having breakfast the other day with Billy and stuff, and you know, Wayne got up to leave, and he left his little book by himself. You know, there was a little book, like a journal he left, you know, and Wayne got up and he left, you know, and I looked at Rosie and I go, "Oh, God, Wayne left his little journal. He's probably writing a step for us or some shit, you know, and I..." It's probably his fifth, probably Greg's fifth step, you know. Anyway, so I ran after Wayne. I'm running down the parking lot over there at that McCowan's restaurant. Wayne, you forgot your book, you know. And Wayne says, "That ain't my book, you know." And I realized that I just went off with the, you know, the reservation book of the hotel, you know. Anything to make that point, you know, I just... But just a laziness is a part of me, you know, and everything will be done tomorrow, you know. And if I do something, I want recognition for it right away, you know. I put a toilet seat on for my wife about 5 years ago. A memorable thing in my mind, you know what I mean? I remember the weirdest thing. I mean, Don brought us into Seaside, and the only thing that I've remembered is that the police department has 14 cars, you know. And me and Rosie are busy. I put a nice piece of wood in that toilet, you know, a nice cherry wood, and you know, and we're busy in AA. And every time we'd come home from meetings, she'd go into the bathroom, and I'd go into my bedroom, and she'd be in there in the bathroom, and I'm thinking on that bed, I'm going, "Oh, man, how selfish can you be? That's a brand new piece of wood she's sitting on in there, you know. She didn't even say thank you or nothing, you know." And for 3 months, man, she'd go in there, and I'm going, "Man, what are they teaching her at these stag meetings, you know?" Finally, she came out and, you know, bothered me. I said, "You know, that's a piece of cherry wood you're sitting on in there? Who do you think put it on there, God? It was old Lawrence of Torrance that put that thing on there, you know?" "Oh," she says, "I know, and it's loose, too, you know?" "It's loose now." "That's loose," you know. But you see, when you're as lazy as I am, and you've got this ego bigger than Portland, you grow up doing average things expecting standing ovations. I'm the type of guy that goes to work, and I think the boss is in the office going, "Oh, Jesus Christ, man. Boy, they don't make them like that anymore, you know. That guy put in 8 hours, man. Woo, where do they get those? Is there any more of those around, you know? And he only took an hour lunch. You've got to be kidding me. Wow," you know. "I always got to get recognition for stuff I should be doing anyway." You know what I mean? You know. sponsor gives you direction, you come running back. Hey, I did that and it works. Dude, don't tell me. I know it does. I told you, goof. Tell him, you know. We had my grandfather stayed with us for a while, you know, and my grandfather was a painter. He was from Scandinavia. He always told me that I look better than my sisters. That'll make you feel like a champ. I do. No, I'm kidding. I had a great home. I'm around 11 years old, and there's no way anything about me is going to measure up to what my dad wants me to be. No way. There's something about me going on in here that I carry with me to this very day. And that is this little underlying fear. This invisible barrier between me and my friends and the people out there. And no matter how physically and how well I fit into whatever the activity is in the group of people, there's something in me that tells me, nah, this ain't it either. I ain't like them. I'm always going to be different. I've always got this fear. I've always got this restless and irritable and discontent in me about it. Always got this sick envy. Everybody always looks like they're doing well. Everybody always seems to be on the next page. And I'm always struggling. And I'm like a little plane, always out of whack like this. Just a lost crop duster. And around 11 years old, I took a shot of whiskey. And whoop! Baby, I'm stealth. I'm flying. I am. It was the most fantastic thing that ever happened in my mind. You know, I couldn't believe the things, and then I puked. But I never forgot that half hour of happiness that I found, because I never found it when I was sober. There would never be an activity or an action or a group that would never make me feel like that place that I found when I was drinking. Now, I didn't head out to Skid Row that next, you know, or nothing the next day, you know, but I got the address, you know, because I knew that was going to be my secret to life at an early age. At an early age, I knew that was going to be my little secret, and my secret to going to be my ace in the hole. And that would be the thing that would even out the playing field between me and you, you know. And I tell you, I was obsessed my entire life with the idea that if I could get my life to be somewhat normal, everything would be all right. And if you're new, if you're not careful, to the untrained eye, that looks like what happens here. People come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they stop drinking, and they get a little room, and they get a little car, and they get somebody to dance with, and they get a little job, and to the untrained eye, it looks like the treatment for alcoholism is normal living. And there's nothing could be further from the truth, because there's people sitting in this room right now, in that very row, who've got every material instinct satisfied. They don't have room for another car. And they're a little bit restless, and they're irritable, and discontented, because the treatment for alcoholism is not BMW. The treatment for alcoholism is not working more overtime. The treatment for alcoholism is not getting another degree. The most famous picture in Alcoholics Anonymous are those two guys and the man on the bed. It speaks volumes to us. Now, I beg to ask you this question. Do you really think those two guys are telling that guy, dude, you need to work more overtime? Do you think that's what he's telling that guy? And all my life, I thought that's what would happen. If I could get my life into some type of normal living, maybe that would be all right. The treatment for alcoholism, thank God, will never change. And it isn't up to anybody but us to keep it that way. And don't you worry about violating traditions. Don't you worry about that. We don't need policemen here. We've got the number one cop in our life, and it's called John Barleycorn. And if these traditions are violated, you don't got to worry about straightening these people up. They'll get drunk. Sooner or later, they will get drunk. It's a guarantee. And that's the blood, and that's the soul that this foundation is based on. That's why those traditions were written. We aren't the first group of people that come through here with having pill problems and identification problems. We're not the first group. That's been an ongoing battle, you know? And And so I started drinking when I was 11, and like I said, I would sneak it into school and stuff like that, and I started separating me and my family, and I never become a part of that family, really. Hated my dad to the time after I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, because he represented everything I should be doing, you know. And I'm a freshman in high school, and I start dating this little Mexican girl. And she had some brothers, and they like cars. They like lowered cars. They like car shows and just lowered Chevrolets down to here. We used to get our hair up real big, like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, you know. Get some white T-shirts with our black khaki pants up to here. And just drive around and drinking that cheap Thunderbird wine and listening to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye. And God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck the other day, and the Four Tops came on. I just start sinking in my damn truck. I loved it, man. I had a little Mexican girl named Lupi. She had her hair curled up real big. I had my hair curled up real big. Some of the women that were I was hanging with told me that men who are well endowed had big feet, so I had a pair of 15-inch shoes, you know. Driving around with big feet and big ideas. Got that frown on my face because my ass hurts from driving around all night, you know. Everything I would ever need, I would find in that car, man. And I loved it. I loved it, you know. And all we did is rob houses and drive around like that, you know. Oh, man, I loved it. I was in the Glendale Mall not too long ago, and I went up there, and I ran by a kid like that. Kid was about 18 years old. He's got a bald head, just shaved. And he's got a tank top on. He's all tatted down. He's got these big pants you can put about 5 kids in, you know. He's got 3 cell phones because he's an important kid, you know. I walk by him. He's got his mom's earrings on. He's got a stud in here. He's got a diamond in here. He's got a hook in his nose. He's got a ball bearing in his tongue. He's got a chain to his wallet. I walk by him. He goes, "What are you looking at?" I said, "I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at, you know. I really don't. I have no idea what I'm looking at, you know. And the longer I look at you, the weirder you get, you know." And we started talking, and now I sponsor the kid, you know. And I remember Ron's in Chula Vista, and he used to call me up when he was new, you know. "What do you want me to do, sponsor?" "Gee, Ron, why don't you unlock yourself, for Christ's sake, you know?" "Yeah, but I go to these meetings and I feel so different." "Really?" "Maybe it's because it's that chain link fence you're wrapped up in, kid, you know. Come on out of there, you know." "Oh, I feel different." "I know you do, Ron, you know." God, I loved it, man. And man, everything I'd ever need, I'd find around bouncing in those cars, you know. All my life, I thought my problems was because I was Mexican. And I took an inventory with my sponsor and found out I'm just a white guy. You know, I really wanted to be Mexican. It would just, you know, it would really just, you know, I could go, okay, that's why I'm so obsessed with Latin women, you know, just, but especially that one. And thank you. In fact, only that one. I'm sure about that. As it all comes back, it's right. Yeah, and I was gay up until I met her, really. I never. Yep, that's right. That's it. I brought her just so Harlan would know I wasn't gay, you know? Anyway, and I would bounce around, and I loved it, man. We'd drive around and drinking that cheap wine and everything. I loved it, and it was you could not tell me that my alcoholic life was bad. That was the safest place I'd ever been, and the thing about my drinking is like this. Every time I drank, it opened up a big beautiful picture. Every time I drank, every time I'd throw back that wine, big beautiful picture. And the trouble with this alcoholic was that the longer I drank, the smaller that picture got. Smaller that picture got, and the smaller that picture got, and my demand for that picture got greater. And by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was just praying for a shot in a keyhole. And I was obsessed with this idea, someday, somehow, I'm going to get that beautiful picture again. Because I've got to get it, because I'm sober now and I'm absolutely out of my mind. I'm absolutely out of my mind. And I wished I could stay sober on the memory of my last drunk. I wish that would shape me up. Because I've got some memories that'll keep other people sober, but I wish the memory of my last drunk would. But the problem with this alcoholic is once I'm sober, the memory of my last drunk is washed away by the pain I feel today. And the longer I stay sober, the least I'm concerned about the memory of my life, because I'm concentrated on the pain that I feel today, and I just want a little bit of peace right now. And I don't know that every time I drink, I got a phenomenon of craving. I don't know that every time I drink, I'm going to add another page to the nightmares that are going to face me when I'm sober. The long list of nightmares that follow the alcoholics when they come to alcohol. The alcoholic who still suffers. We're not talking about DTs. We're talking about a man and a woman's life for year and year after year of their pain and suffering when they're sober, and they know perfectly well what that drunk's going to do. They know perfectly well what that next shot of whiskey's going to do, but damn it, maybe this time it'll be different. Maybe this time I can control that spot. Maybe this time I can get in that happy spot and then watch it from there. And that's all I was trying to do, is get that little spot open and the phenomena could just make that spot last a little longer. And I didn't know that I was going to wake up in Arizona the next day. I was just trying to control and enjoy the most magnificent spot I've ever been in. The one that I know that I can't find when I'm sober. I didn't know about a phenomenon of craving. I didn't know about anything else. My whole life swirled around that first drink. Everything about it. I don't care what my motive or any. Everything was surrounded about that first drink, that next drink. My life depended on it, you know. And by the time I'm 1969, a lot of my buddies are going different places. Some of them are going to Vietnam, and some of them are going to San Francisco and turning hippie. And I don't know what to do with my life. So I thought maybe I'll go to Detroit and find my roots. And so me and my buddy head out to Detroit, and we wound up in Phoenix. And I'm over there at Phoenix on North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel. It's got about 6 floors, and all the rooms are $35 a month. Everybody's got a little room and a hot plate and a hot TV, and they got a Murphy bed that you fold down, and you can look out your little window and drink and dream and die and know that one of these days it ain't going to be like that. One of these days, I'm going to be like those guys out there with lunch buckets and everything, and everything's going to be all right, but right now, I just got to get out of this spot. You know, when I took my inventory with my sponsor, I found out that my life was a series of fresh starts. Always starting over. Always starting over. A new town, a new hotel, new probation officer, you know what I mean? You know why that is? It's because when you're a loser, that's the only way you get hope. You start over. You start over. Losers don't know about hanging in and working through things and seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. And no. We quit, we run, we start over. We quit, we run, we start over. And I knew maybe this time, and I'm over there on Arizona, and I meet up with this guy, and I start working for a plumber. I don't know nothing. So the guy sticks me underneath the house. He says, we're going to repipe a house. He says, all I want you to do is get underneath the house and just nail the copper. That's all you got to do, kid. You got it. And he took off. I had a pint of Kessler's, had a transistor radio under there, you know, and I'm, man, there's a little cat over in the corner, you know. I got it made under here. I crawled over to the little crawl space. I look out there, and I see all the cars going by. I go, man, I'm on top of the world. I'm underneath the house. I got a pint. I got a transistor radio, got a little kitty, never had a pet before, you know. Every now and then I'll bang on the pipes, let them know I'm hard at work, you know what I mean? Man, I capped the seal of that 200 temperature degree bourbon through that back, man, and 9 hours later they're dragging me out from underneath the house, you know. Apparently I'd gotten drunk and I busted through the bedroom and I stole all the ladies' jewelry and I brought it down underneath the house, you know, and they're pulling me out. They're pulling this cat out because it's got a ton of necklaces on, you know. And, you know, just. So I got canned from that job, you know. And then I went to Volt and I started selling tuxedos over in Arizona in the middle of July, you know. Door to door. hey, Betty, look at this shit, you know, and that lasted for about 2 hours, and then I started working for another plumber, and I started digging a ditch, and I found out that he was younger than me, so I dug a ditch for about 2 hours, and I faked a knee injury at him, you know, went down, got some Kesslers, and went down to the bar, meet up with a guy named Ernie. Ernie's from Tennessee. Ernie's an idea man. Ernie says, Larry, he says, I know how we're going to make some money, kid. He says, we're going to get you down. Not too far from there is a horse track. And he says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey. Really? I'm thinking we're going to start exercising and stuff, you know. And he says, I want you to take some of this. And he had a bag of speed. And I just been minding my own business, drinking my wine and doing heroin. I know nothing about that, you know. I want you to take this and, you know, after about 2 months, we'll come and weigh you in. And he took off, you know. And I don't know nothing about this stuff. Well, he comes back 2 weeks later, and I'm stuck in the doorway. I don't want to be a jockey, Ernie. I'm going faster than any damn horse I've ever seen in my life, man. You know, I've been in my room for 10 days just, you know, chasing a fly around, you know, and looking out my window, seeing these black and white flashes, which was the sun going up and down, you know. God, Ernie, you couldn't have possibly taken it. Well, I sure didn't. I need some more right now, you know. And worst 10 days of my life, man. And I went to a doctor. I faked another injury, and I got a doctor for some prescription pills. And we started drinking that Old Crow, and I started, we met some guys from Tucson and Nogales, and they knew some doctors, and I started writing prescriptions. Started writing a lot of prescriptions and selling them. Started writing prescriptions for Seconal and Nembutal and Obitrol and Tuinol, and you name it all, I wrote it all, you know. And damn near took it all, too, you know. And after about 9 months, they caught up with me, which, you know, when you're on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase, you know what I mean? There he goes down to 605. Boy, let's go get him. You know, it's just a matter of the sheriff coming into the Busy Bee Hotel going, oh, there he is under there. You know? So they arrested me and convicted me, and I was in southern Arizona for a while. And in 1974, they give me a $45 voucher to come back to California, and I go to the city hall, and I register over there, and they give me a voucher for a Greyhound Hotel in downtown Torrance. It's about $35 a month. Everybody's got a hot plate and a hot TV, and I'm looking out my window, and I'm drinking and I'm dying. And I know one of these days it's all going to be different, and my window's getting very small. My window's getting very small. But I can't imagine life without it. I can't imagine life without it. I'm the type of alcoholic that, given all the circumstance and knowledge about this disease, it does me no bit of good because of the pain that I feel today. I'll be sitting on an emergency ward gurney with the hoses going in me one more time and the ambulance dropping me off. And the only thought that I have after an hour is I got to get to Eddie's Liquor Store, get me off this gurney. You make that go away. Bill Wilson says it so well. I drank for the guilt of my passions, and then I drank more to make my passions possible. Caught in that hamster cage, the alcoholic life, the torture that only me and you know about, where we know perfectly well we shouldn't be doing it, but we have no power whatsoever to keep from taking that. We are the only ones that have loved ones begging with us, our own evidence, chunks of liver, consequences galore, and the alcoholic is the only one that I know that'll push all that aside for, let me have one more shot. This time it'll be different. This time has got to be different, you know. And I'm over at the hotel in 1974. I'm about 2 months. I'm on Anabuse, and I no drinking or using or anything. And after 2 months, they find me in a Little League dugout in El Segundo, California, at 10 o'clock in the morning, absolutely out of my mind. I've got paranoias, and I've got schizophrenia, and I'm my paranoias are so bad that I'm hallucinating and I don't know what to do. I can't shut off the voice, and I don't know what, and I'm absolutely sober, don't got any medication, nothing in my mind. And they call the paramedics and they take me to the Harvard General Hospital. They diagnose by the size of my jacket that maybe I need to be put away in a nut house, and maybe be observed for 30 days. And they sent me out to one out there by Oxnard, California. And a year later, they sent me there to be observed, and a year later, they took me out, totally observed. And they told me that I wouldn't be able to operate. They told me I wouldn't be able to operate in society without any medication for the rest of my life. That there's no way you're going to go out there, hotshot, without taking this. You're going to need this medication. You better never miss your medication. And I had no reason to debate. 2 months after I was there, I ran out of Thorazine. And they found me over at Overo Street in downtown Los Angeles, curled up, a public drunk, a public nuisance. And they rolled me up and they sent me up to Wayside, California, where I was going to stay up there till I was going to be convicted for a violation. And after about 40 days, they put a bunch of us in a black and white bus and sent us down to the South Bay Courthouse in Torrance, California. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm in a holding tank and everybody's gone. They're just me and old bologna sandwiches. All the buses are gone, and I'm just hoping I can hear some keys. And the only thought that I have is, where am I going now? It's the only thought that I've ever had. Where am I going now? And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Scottish man with a patch slid open a cell door, and he said, are you Larry Thomas? And I said, yes, sir, I am. He says, my name is Alex, son. Why don't you come with me? We're going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell you, what makes that visit so memorable to me is the man had no business being there. He came there unsolicited. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't a therapist. He wasn't a probation officer. He was a refinery worker. And he just got the worst news of his life. His poor wife was dying, and she was dying quick. And he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in his meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, somewhere in his book studies of Alcoholics Anonymous, somewhere with his sponsor, he grasped and developed a manner of living, which incorporated that first paragraph of working with others that states this: practical experience tells us that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when other activities fails. He knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. And he turned that car around and went to the South Bay Courthouse. He talks to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth, and they said, I think we got a guy you can talk to. And he slid open that door and he said, come with me, son, you're going to AA. And I'm ready for a long ride and maybe some lunch. And this guy took me to a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that car, he told me the most miraculous news that I've ever heard. He says, son, I know you've had a hard life, and I know you feel different. And he got me. I've been feeling different my entire life. And he says, we're going to Alcoholics Anonymous, Larry, and you don't have to worry about feeling different. He says, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are. He says, the only people that are well-adjusted and happy are the Al-Anon seeing your ass leave, you know. Took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Took me for a 20-minute car ride to this little dingy club over in Torrance, California called the TLC Club. And it said TLC Alano. I don't know what an Alano is. You know, my dad used to go to the Elks Lodge and the Moose Lodge and the Eagle Lodge, and I thought it was another animal club, you know, watch for crossing Alanos, you know, or something, you know. And he took me into this Alano club, you know, and my God, man, he introduced me to a little lady named Moose and Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt and all these other people, man. I thought, my God, I just came out of a place like this, you know. Little Moose come running after me like a slow motion toilet commercial. Hi, honey, my name is Moose and I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are, sweetheart. I ain't it, you know. And then this big transvestite came out of the card room and he started circling me like a helicopter, you know. And he, After about his third time around, he landed and he came over to me and he said, "I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting." A candlelight meeting? I said, "I don't think so, you know." I turned to Alex and I said, "My God, that guy's got big feet." You know, and then, I took one look around, I said, "My God, if this is AA, I don't want any, you know, I don't want to crack that book open," you know what I mean? And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, 60 days and get drunk, 90 days and get drunk, and the longest I could stay sober was I was on heroin. And that don't make me a worse alcoholic or a better member. All that did is prove to me one important thing, that if I, this alcoholic, if I don't change, my sobriety date will. You know, I mean, it's about that simple. It is really that simple. It is not a complicated thing. Or, you know, if you're new and you're just so happy with the way things are, well, hang in, you know. But I was not looking only for sobriety, but I was looking for sobriety and a brand new way of life. Would you like a brand new way of life? Or is the back of that alley so damn comfortable you can't stand it? You know what I mean? And I had to surrender to the fact that I'll take this muddy old greasy sobriety any old way I can get it. And that the illusion that I was going to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and it would shield me from life's little bullets had to be smashed. Because if you are new, be prepared to be smack dab in the middle of life, and you better have a program, and you better have a sponsor, and you better have a rut of meetings. You betcha. I'm in the worst period of my life. I've never thought this. I used to hate this. I was a free spirit. I remember my sponsor picking me up. You know, Brandy, he says, "My God," he says, "you seem to be some type of free spirit." He says, "You know, what kind of work do you do?" And I says, "Well, I'm kind of a jack of all trades." He says, "Oh, you can't hold a job." He says, "Do you have any girlfriends or a wife?" I says, "No, I'm a free spirit." He says, "Oh, you're a cheater." Yeah, I didn't like the way this interview was going, man, you know. Yep, worst years of my life. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me. And they were always clean and they were sharp. I called that central office. Central office. People making 12-step calls. People coming to there and sitting with that drunk. And not sending him off somewhere unless he was physically, he had to go somewhere. Sitting with that drunk. Puking with that drunk. Shaking with that drunk. Being with that drunk. God, what a thing we have almost wiped out in Alcoholics Anonymous. The common suffering has almost been erased. Where we go let them do their suffering in private. That common suffering, I don't ever want to forget. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody was clean and they were sharp and they came and got. I don't wear this tie because I think I'm sharp and effective. I wear this tie because the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, some of them sitting in this room today, have taught me how to hold a job. And that if I can't show respect for the thing that's saving my life, how will I ever show respect for a wife and a boss and a child? I'll tell you the most important ingredient in my life. One of the most important ingredients in my life today is that what I do in between meetings has everything to do with me being an Alcoholics Anonymous member without telling anybody I am. What I'm doing when I'm away from you and how I'm at work and with my wife and with everybody out there has everything to do with me being a member without telling anybody I am. It's easy to be cute for an hour and a half and shake, "Hello, how are you?" Well, what do you like when you leave here, pal? And that's where you live. That's where you're the Alcoholics Anonymous member. That's when you're a member of AA, when no one's looking. That's when God's grace works through you. The grace of God is a word that's thrown around in Alcoholics Anonymous like 90 Day Chip. Grace of God is that compassion for the suffering. That compassion that people had for you when you were new. But if you never return that compassion, you don't have it. You've just experienced it. You've just went through it. the grace of God. I don't ever want to forget what it's like to welcome a shaking, sweaty, stinky man to Alcoholics Anonymous and tell him, buddy, why don't you ride with me tonight? I live in my rut. I'm a real boring guy. One of the things that I've always wanted to run away from was being in a rut. I don't want to be in a rut. I don't want to have the same job. I don't want to have the same, you know what I mean? My meetings are my rut. I love my rut. I have a series of meetings, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and most of the time I'm gone on the weekend. And I live in that rut. And the guys that I sponsor can find me at those meetings. And I can find my sponsor at those meetings because I know all heck will break loose in between. But there's nothing like being crazy and knowing where you're supposed to be. The worst thing an alcoholic can feel is to be sober, kind of goofy, and not knowing where he should go that night. What meeting should I go? But when you're committed to a meeting, there's nothing like being goofy and knowing that in an hour and a half, baby, I'm floating into my book study. In an hour and a half, I'm floating into my tradition study. In an hour and a half, I'm going to make coffee for people I can't stand. You know what I mean? And I need those kind of hooks. I need those kind of hooks in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And like I said, in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1980, there's a guy doing his 12-step work. And like I said, every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd call this bald-headed carpenter, this guy named Don. And Don would come, and he would ask me the only thing, are you ready to go to a meeting? And in 1980, I'm up at the Don Hotel over there in Wilmington. I've got a hot plate and a hot TV. I got a PM bourbon bottle cut in half. I'm watching Jeopardy so I could really feel like an idiot, you know. And 10 o'clock in the morning, I hear this, Larry, it's Don. Oh, my God, what's that guy doing here? I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here, you know. Can I come in? And he opened up the door, and he says, oh, my God, you had 15 days. You had 15 days, kid. You're going to be a janitor in the city of Lomita. There's some hope, you know. And I looked at that guy with all my sincerity, and I took a shot of that whiskey bottle, and I said, Don, I don't want what you got. I don't want what you have, and if I ever get that bad, I'll know what to do, and excuse my French. Well, why don't you just get the hell out of my room and let me do what I want to do? And the man looked at me, and he turned, and he walked away. And for the next 15 seconds, the nightmare started. It shot me back to 1967 when me and my dad are fighting. And he's kicking me out of the house because I'm selling drugs and getting drunk. And he told me, if you want to live that way, that's your business. But I got a wife and two daughters. Why don't you go do that under your own roof, hotshot? And I make physical contact with my father. A nightmare that was to follow me into Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things that I would laugh about with my friends, but one of the things that crushed me when I was alone. You see, when everybody else, after we were drinking, would go off dancing and go off and doing certain things, I would go and I'd find me a bar where people twice my age were hanging out. And I'd take myself a couple shots of that whiskey and I'd saddle up to a guy that kind of reminded me of my dad. And I'd talk to him like he was my dad. I'd talk to him about the Dodgers and the Navy and stuff like that. I'd find ladies that were twice my age and reminded me of my mom and just sit there and talk to them as if they were my mom. I never want to forget that. I never want to forget the life of this alcoholic. And in about 15 seconds, all that left my head as the only answer to life I ever had is that bald-headed carpenter. And from 1980 to 1982, I'm stuck with the memory of you. And I can't stay drunk and I can't stay sober and they both feel the same. And on May 2nd, 1982, I'm standing in front of a Woolworth sweater in downtown Wilmington. I've just checked into the Beacon Light Mission. I go by this window, and I look at myself. I catch eyes with the thing, and the thing's about 120 pounds, and he's yellow. I got my hair down to my neck, and I've got my little rented clothes on, and I look at myself, and I go, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? All I ever wanted to be was a cameraman. How come I can't stay drunk and I can't stay sober? Whatever happened to that kid that could run like a deer? Whatever happened to that kid that had opportunities to model ties and do all? Whatever happened to that kid? Just to turn and walk away and panhandle some money. I panhandled some money. It was the thing that I always did when I got like that. I panhandled some money and I called Alcoholics Anonymous on May 1st, 1982. I called Central Office and they give me this Alano Club in Torrance. And who do I get? I get Don. Don, this is Larry. I'm down here at the Beacon Light Mission. I'm ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Will you come and get me? And Don told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no, Get your rusty ass down here yourself. I'm tired of chasing after Soup. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your rusty rear down here? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. And I said, my God, whatever happened to that AA love, you know? And I just heard it. And I took the longest walk of my life that morning, 10 miles from Wilmington to Torrance. And with my poopy pants and no hope, I came to you. I went into that club, and I was asking everybody, and I said, do you know where Don is? And he's back by the coffee bar. And I walked up to that guy, and for the first time in my life, I walked up to a guy, and I said, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds, and then he lit into me for 20 minutes, man. And he told me under no certain terms was he going to put up with my nonsense. He says, I want to tell you something, hotshot. He says, you make the effort, I make the effort. You don't make the effort, you call somebody else. I've been watching you come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time, and the only thing you ever do is come here to get. Where's mine? What's this? Where's my chip? Where's my seat? You've never come here to give a darn thing. And he says, things are going to change here, pal, and you ain't going to wait till you get a year. You're not going to, you know, don't drink unless your ass falls off. Come back 30 days later, no ass. You know what I mean? He says, you want to find God, grab the end of a mop. He hides out at the end of mops. And I've been an active member of my home group. See, there's this thing going around Alcoholics Anonymous that if you're 15 years sober or more, you don't have to do anything in your meetings anymore. There's this thing in Alcoholics Anonymous that the commitments in meetings are just for the new guys to get them out of yourself. Don't you come to my group and touch my coffee pot. That's my commitment. I need a hook just as much as anybody else. I'm an active member in my home group, and that means I do more than put in a buck and criticize. I can survive without being behind this box anytime, but I don't ever want my ego to be too big for my home group. I don't want my ego ever to be too big where I can't sit and listen for 4 times a week. Why do I always going to be talking? I need to sit and listen to the sweet music of a loving God as express himself to the program, and it's not coming through my voice all the time. It's coming from the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to be an active member of my home group. And that's what I am, because there was an atmosphere that was created when I showed up. When I showed up, there was an active atmosphere showed up. People got up and they were there and they took parts of their home. See, my home group is my house where my God lives. That's God's house. And when you come to our house, my home group, or you come to my house in Lakewood, at the end of the evening, I wouldn't say, would you help me clean the bathroom? I have commitments in my home group, and we do things in our home group so that when you're a guest in my home group, whether you be new or visiting, there will be nothing you need to do to distract you from the vital message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything is for your comfort, so nothing will distract you and that message. And you will be able to hear the traditions, and you will be able to hear the readings, and you will be able to hear the common suffering of the alcoholic that I need to hear, and you will also hear the solution of. You will take your problems to your sponsor and bring your solutions to your meetings, so all you hear are answers in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what the atmosphere I need to be in. And it's my responsibility as an active member of my home group to make sure I'm doing whatever I can to recreate that atmosphere. That it ain't about just coming and getting. That because you got 10 or 15 years, you don't need to do anything in your home group because you got yours. Oh my God, how many times have we heard people come up and they take their cakes? And I am so blessed. And I've been blessed with a daughter, and I've been blessed with a new job, and I've been blessed with this house over here, and I'm blessed with this limousine. And within months, days, or years, they begin to hang themselves with their great blessings. Because they forget to come back to the place that blessed them when no one else would. I don't ever want to forget where it starts and where it ends is with you. The people of Alcoholics Anonymous, the program called Alcoholics Anonymous in its entirety. It is so misjudged. It is the most miraculous thing we've ever sat in our entire lives, and the power is unending. And on May 2nd, 1982, I came into that room and I asked that man to be my sponsor, and he got me immediately busy. Busy helping you, helping meetings, getting out of self. And at a year and a half sober, I started backing away from that man. I started judging that guy. He was doing some things and things were going on, and I started backing away from my sponsor. And for about 6 months, I was running my own life. And that's always a treat, you know. I mean, I got a busy head as it is. I'm the type of alcoholic that no matter how tired I am, when I want to sleep, my head wants to chat. I could be physically beat. I was last night. I was tired. I laid my head down. 3 o'clock in the morning, my head wants to chat. Hey, Larry, you in there? Look it, I want to chat. I want to talk about when you were a baby and bring you right up to date, you know? And the sad thing about that is we just did that the night before, you know? No memory, you know what I mean? But at 2 years sober, I'm down at a club and a man came down there. And he told me about a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, there's a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous, son. I hope you find it. And I followed that man. I followed that man to my now home group. My sponsors, Johnny, and my home group was a big group of Bellflower, California. And I tell you that because it's the most proudest thing I have in my life. I don't like to say it because people think I'm from Bellflower, and I don't want to admit that, you know what I mean? And I know what it's like to come to a home group where there's a lot of people. I know what that's like. It's like getting sober in the airport, for Christ's sakes, you know what I mean? And one more time, you're faced with all those people, and I don't do good with a lot of people, man, because I'm not like them. And I remember being new and seeing all these guys around my sponsor, and they all had glasses on, and they all had clean clothes on, and I'm looking at them going, here we go again, man. And it was clear to me that he liked them better. It was so clear. He was so kind to them and shaking their hands and hugging them, and all he would tell me is, coffee black. Coffee black. Coffee black. Sit there. Do this. You know, he wouldn't even let me get close to the circle. You know what I mean? And every time Johnny would take out of town, I would call this guy up. I'd call, hey, how come Johnny likes you better? Oh, Larry, it ain't like that at all. It's not like that at all, man. The old man just knows us longer. You're just a new kid on the block. Let him get to know you and things will be okay. And after a period of time, think, but he doesn't like it. But I started that old trick, you know, that old people-pleasing trick. And the worst person for me to do is to try to people-please my sponsor. When I start people-pleasing my sponsor, I want his approval so much that I'll start holding back secrets just to get his nod. My God, he knows you're a goof. You know what I mean? And I had to get friends, and I had to get some running buddies, you know? And now the amazing thing about that is 24 years later, Johnny takes off and he goes away for the weekend, and I get these calls. Larry, how come Johnny likes you better? I said, because you're a loser. And me and my sponsor started going through that book, and we started taking that inventory. And I met the two most beautiful people in my life, my mother and my father. Beautiful people in my life, making amends to my mother where she no longer has to worry. When my mom thinks of me today, she has peace of mind. She knows I'm with you guys. She knows that. And those amends were hard. It was more than just a 15-minute visit. You know, and my dad, I made my amends to my dad when I was 5 years sober, you know. And I didn't know how to be friends with him. And so Thursday night, me and my dad would go have chili. And we'd have chili. And some there were long afternoons. I didn't know how to talk to him. I didn't know what to say. But I started talking to him like I would my sponsor. I would start talking to him about things that he enjoyed, the Navy, the sports and stuff, instead of always telling him my problem, how I'm doing in AA, all that stuff. I started talking about things that interested him. I started letting him in on my personal life. He became my best friend.
Out of shadow of a doubt. There was nothing like me and the old man riding around. And the longer I stayed sober, man, the closer we got. And he was so much like us. He had a sense of humor that couldn't be beat. And then the last 2 years of his life, because he had some type of cancer and it went pretty slow, we would still have our Thursday night chili night. But you see, for years at the end of every meeting, I was holding men's hands at the end of meetings, and we were saying the Lord's Prayer. And on my birthday, men were hugging and kissing me, and on their birthday, I was hugging and kissing them. And every time I'd see my dad, when I'd go over and take care of him and wash him, and we would take care of his bills and stuff, I would kiss him on the forehead, and you know what? I didn't feel weird about it. I didn't feel weird about telling Dad that I loved him. Not at all. And I was there the day that he passed. And I never want to forget that, because I'm filling out his checks and I'm making sure that things are all right. And I went into the bedroom to see how Dad was, and Dad was gone. And I kissed that man on the forehead and closed his eyes, and I said, "Thank you, Papa. Thank you for everything you ever did for me." One of the things I resented about my dad is when I turned 13 years old, he gave me 5 pages of legal paper of now that you're a young man, what you're supposed to do. And it startled me, and I threw it away. I read it, and it was just too overwhelming. As I stand here today, close to 25 years sober, every one of those demands have been met. He never asked anything more than you folks asked. He just wanted the best for me. He just wanted me to be happy, joyous, and free, and living the good life. Like any father would for his children. Like I believe my Heavenly Father wants for me and you. Just to be happy, joyous, and free. And when he died, I didn't know what to do with that Thursday night void. I had a big void because that was me and Dad's night. And it was about 2 weeks, and I get a call from my sponsor on a Thursday night before our tradition book study. And he says, "What are you doing tonight, kid?" And I says, "Well, in about 2 hours, I'm getting ready to go to our tradition meeting, Sponce." He says, "Why don't you come pick me up? Let's go have some chili." Now, I tell you what, that's exactly what my head did. It gave him a standing O. And every Thursday night, I pick up that man, and we go having chili. And I love my life today. I've got a great life. What are you going to do with a guy like me? I don't know nothing. I come from nothing. Alcoholics Anonymous made me a plumber. They took me out of the gutter and stuck me in the sewer, for Christ's sakes, you know. And I want to tell you about some stuff, and then we'll all go home. At about 10 years sober, I got my life coming out my sleeve. I want to thank the men from Manuka Retreat for being here. I want to thank you guys. Because me and you touched that place. Me and you were with each other not too long ago. And you turned a page in my life. You turned a page in my life that I will never forget. Because one more time, you reeled me in to love and service of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how important it is for us to share our experience, strength, and hope, and that our past will become our greatest. I want to thank you guys for that, and I'll never forget that. Never forget that. And at 10 years sober, my life's going out my sleeve. I'm going through a divorce, and I've got this little 2-year-old daughter, and she's jumping up in my arms. And with her holy socks and her holy underwear, she's looking at me and not saying it, but she's saying, "Daddy, if you love me, why do you dress me this way?" And what's going on with Daddy is Daddy can't hold a job at 10 years sober. At 10 years sober, Daddy's got a resentment. At 10 years sober, his first wife and him are going to divorce, and she ain't getting a penny. And you know how you do that, men? You stay poor at them. And you don't hold jobs. And you work for day labor, and you lie on your taxes, and you make your daughter suffer, but by God, you're right. You're not living by principles, but you're right. And there's nothing like being right, is there? When you've been wrong your entire life, and every time I'd visit that little girl, she'd hop up in my arms with her muddy face and her dirty little feet, and that's my fault. And I couldn't stand it anymore. And I went to my grand sponsor because Johnny was gone somewhere. And Clancy had me in his office. And I called him the day before. I told Clancy what was going on. He says, "Why don't you come down to the mission?" And I said, "You mean you don't want me to go to your office? You want me to just come down to the mission? Is that what you said?" He says, "No." He says, "I want you to find an abandoned warehouse and I'll come get you, you know." So I went down to that mission and me and Clancy talked, and he gave me a little stack of papers and he says, "Go take them to my boss." And without a debate at all, I took those papers over to the boss and come back. And for the first time in my life, I took an action and I didn't debate it. I didn't have to ask, why me? Why not you? Why this? It dawned on me that if I can do that for a boss, that maybe my little girl can have clean socks. And maybe that wife can have what's hers. And maybe I can get over this god-awful resentment that's driving me to drink. And the next day, I looked through the newspaper and I got me a three little sentence job. It says, "Wanted, man who knows the streets of LA and have clean DMV. Bingo. I went down there and I've been working for him ever since. And my daughter, she's now 19. And when I go see her, she doesn't hop up in my arms, but she still runs to me and says, 'Daddy, I love you.' And if I can go to Seattle and Portland and talk, why can't I go to Phoenix and see my little girl? What's more spiritual?" And the women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, "You may not be somebody's husband, but you'll always be somebody's father. Don't you ever let that little girl wonder where you're at. Whether you write her or call her or see her, always keep in contact with that little girl. And don't write her with legal yellow paper. Use Pocahontas paper, you know." And me and my beautiful wife, we go see her, and we try to see her, and the older she gets, the least she wants to see of me, you know what I mean? But when I do see her, the last time that I see her, I rolled in there, and Rosie was on a retreat, and I went over there by myself, and I looked at my little girl, and she had her mom's earrings on, and she had a diamond stud in her nose, she had a ring in her nose, she had a ball bearing in her tongue, and she had a tattoo that looked like a comic strip all across her tummy. And she looked at me and said, "Daddy, what are you looking at?" And I said, "The most beautiful little girl I've ever seen in my life." Without a doubt. Now, where did I get that? Sponsorship. When I told him about that tattoo, Clancy says, "Don't you ever say a thing about that tattoo. She can't do nothing about it. And if it bothers anyone, it bothers her more than anybody. Don't you say anything about that." And I am so glad that I kept my mouth shut, because now when there's important things to talk about, she can bring them to me without that thought, "Oh shit, he didn't like the tattoo. How am I going to bring him this?" She don't have that. That channel is open. That channel is clear. And she can bring to me anything she, because she's not stopped by my selfishness and my self-centeredness, you know? And she called me up not too long ago. She says, "Daddy," she says, "the kids are making fun of me because I'm so smart." She goes, "Did that ever happen to you?" And like any good alky, I said, "Hell yes. You know, happened to me this morning." Now, where would we get that concept? Where would we get that concept of not saying anything about her tattoo? Right in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there are men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous that you've taught me that our common welfare comes first. And that regardless of where you've been and what tattoo you have and what body parts you got pierced, behind every tattoo, behind every piercing, there's an alky in there. And that's what you need to talk to. You don't talk to the tattoo man or the jeweler. There's a suffering alcoholic in there, and that's who you talk to. And that's who I was looking at with that little girl. There was a little girl behind all that, and that's who I talked to. That's who I talked to. My little wife, Rosie, I met Rosie when about 10 years ago. Just want to be sure, you know. And I was speaking at a meeting in Downey, and at the end of the talk, I had my eyes on this little Nicaraguan lady the whole talk, you know, and she's just gorgeous. And at the end of the meeting, I followed her like a dog, you know, and I followed her out to the parking lot, you know, and we're talking and everything, and she couldn't get rid of me, you know, and she says, "Do you like the backpack?" I says, "I love it, you know. I haven't backpacked my entire life, you know what I mean? My God, I spent enough time out there, you know, but and then I thought, you know, God, I'll do anything to get into the tent, you know. And I've been calling that lady ever since. And I know I love my baby. I know I love my wife. She became the first woman that I told other women about. She becomes the little lady that all my life, all I want to do is come home and see her. I can't wait to see her. She's the one that makes me happy that I'm loyal. She's the one that makes me happy that I'm practicing a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's the one that I want to be with. She's the one that I look for every time I'm away from her. I can hear her and I can feel her. And I've never been able to be there for the important women in my life. But my wife, Cindy, has been going through some tough times recently. And without breaking any little secret or anything, she lost her sponsor immediately at a death. And this happened about a month ago. And thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, because you taught me how to keep my mouth shut and open up my arms. And that she will find her own answers in her own time, but there's nothing like a shoulder to cuddle and cry with. Nothing like it. Nothing like the safety of somebody you love and know that you can go there and give back just a little of what you've given back to me, sweetheart. I look forward every day being with you. And I know things will be okay because we're in this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. What a beautiful life we have here. What a beautiful, beautiful life that we have here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, where people who are so selfish and self-centered finally get a piece of this thing called life. And the search is over. There's a man that I used to talk before in Flagstaff, Arizona. And he had a beautiful home. And in this home was picture windows. And every picture window you looked out of, you had a view of the mountain range. You could look through the bathroom and see the mountains. You can look through the kitchen window and see the mountains. You can look out the bedroom and see the mountains. Every window had a peak view. As I stand here this afternoon in Seaside, Oregon, every window of my life has a picture. And in every picture, you're in it. I can't look out of any window without seeing you. No matter what window I look out, I see the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thought of a God or what he looks like never enters my mind, because something miraculous has happened with me as I'm with you over 24 years, is that I don't have the ability to separate you and my God and AA. I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to separate you, and I don't have to worry about what he looks like either. Because on a Sunday morning in Seaside, I see row after row after row after row after row after row of people who should be dead. And on a Sunday morning in Oregon, we're happy and we're joyous and we're free. And if that isn't God, my God, that's the evidence of a power that I want to play in for the rest of my life. Thank you so much.